I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We're doing something a little bit different with Countercurrents Radio. We've decided that we're going to do a weekly show that will come out every Friday. It's going to be me, John Morgan, and Michael Polignano. We've had a bit of a reorganization at Countercurrents recently. So I am still the editor-in-chief. The webzine editor is now Mike Polignano, and if you're an author who's thinking about writing for the webzine or who already writes for the webzine, Mike is now your contact guy to go to, and you can reach him at mjp@counter-currents.com, and that's also on the website. And what John is going to be focusing on is being the book editor. So we have a lot of book projects that are moving forward and about to appear. And I'm quite confident that this new lineup is going to mean that the eighth year of Countercurrents is going to be by far the most productive ever in terms of books. And also, we're going to keep up the quantity and quality of our online journal. So, Mike, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity to be at Countercurrents again. And it's not something that I had envisioned when I left in 2013. There were a bunch of circumstances leading up to that that I'm not going to get into right now. But I am delighted to be back and, you know, working with two people instead of one. I think each of us brings strengths to the table, and in collaboration, we can definitely make this next year incredible.
Yeah, and for those who are unaware of our history, and there are many, many new readers coming to us who don't know the history, people who have been red-pilled in the last 6 months or 6 weeks. I actually talked to a guy recently who is now a white nationalist who voted for Hillary Clinton last November. So people are changing at light speed, and we're getting new people. So it never hurts to repeat things, even though it sounds like old news to us. But in 2010, Mike Polignano and I founded Countercurrents, and we were business partners in the venture for the first basically 4 years of the webzine and publishing house. And so we're growing, and I asked Mike to come back because what I want to do is take a step back from the day-to-day editing of a webzine, which is a very time-consuming thing, as John can attest.
Oh, yeah.
Because he did it at Write On, and he did it for the first 6 months of this year at Countercurrents as well. I want to take a step back from that, or continue my hiatus from that, which I've been doing for 6 months now, and focus on writing projects of my own, and also increasingly getting book projects managed and to the press. And it's really a full-time juggling act to do all that. And so I thought, well, we should get Mike, who built the website, and nobody's more familiar with its workings than Mike, to actually run the webzine. And I thought it would be good because it's a chance for him to work with authors directly, you know, network, and relate to a lot of people. He's also going to be monitoring and the commentary threads and participating in that and so forth. So I think it's a positive change. We've got quite a lot of new stuff coming up. So if you're a Countercurrents reader, prepare for a blitz of books in the last 6 months of 2017.
Yeah, for sure. We've got I think the list we have goes on for several pages of projects that are in various stages of completion.
Exactly. And we're always looking for new ones too. So what I want to do now, though, is steal shamelessly something from the Daily Shoah, which is their thank yous for their donations, because I always thought that was a wonderful thing. It personalizes the thanking of people instead of me just sending them a little note. I try and personalize these notes too, but, you know, to say it in your own voice, add something to it. And as with the Daily Show, I'm not going to reveal anybody's identity in a way that, would make it possible for somebody to know who I'm talking about. There are personal friends that I will thank by name, but just ordinary donors out there, I'm not going to say anything that's going to compromise your identity. Now, in the future, if you do send a donation and you want me to refer to you by a particular nom de guerre, or if you have a message that you'd like to share, that you'd like to have read out on air, just include that in the comment. And you can do that through PayPal or through our credit card processing site, or through just sending me an email, something to that effect. So anyway, we started doing a fundraiser on the 11th of June, which was the 7th anniversary of Countercurrents going online. And we end our fundraiser on Halloween every year. And our goal this year is to raise $60,000. And I think that's a very realistic goal. And I'm going to prepare an update for the first almost month of the fundraiser, probably for Friday, maybe for early next week. But I just went back through the last 10 days or so of donations, and so I just want to read these thanks out. Also, if you want to make a donation, go to the donate page at counter-currents.com, and there are different options there. So, first of all, I got $88 from somebody I'm just going to call the madman across the water, and he specifically wanted to thank us for bringing back James Mason's Siege. We put that back in stock. We found some crates of it, or cases of it, and put it back in stock yesterday, and I think we've had like 12 orders for it since then. So people are really happy to have this book available again. I also got another symbolic donation of $14.88 from Nigel, who also wants to thank us for bringing back Siege. Now, I got a $20 a month donation from somebody in Oz, $50 from our longtime friend Thomas, $100 from Tim, $200 from Christian, a very good friend, $120 donation in real life when I was in Oslo, a Swedish fan who came over to the Oslo Skanza Forum event, said that he wanted to support the White Nationalist Manifesto and gave me $120 in cash. I got $50 from C recently. That's C as in Charlie, but his name is not Charlie, okay? That's just military lingo. $100 from H. Another $100 from somebody in Denmark. $15 from a secret agent in academia who also included the message, "You will prevail." This was in basically solidarity for Freeburggate. $100 from my old friend in the valley. Let's just put it that way. $20 from R. $10 from up in British Columbia. You know who you are. $50 from S. $185 from a very good friend, Sandy. $200 from J, one of our very staunch supporters. $30 from B. $100 from S. $20 a month from Iceland. Very much appreciated. A $10 a month donation from C. Another $10 a month donation from S. Yet another $10 a month from R. A $20 per month donation from Norway. And another $10 from M. And that comes out to $1,632.88 in the last 10 days. And we really very much appreciate this. We are well on our way to making our goal in this annual fundraising drive. And again, if you want me to give you a shout out the next time we do this, when you have upcoming donations, if you want to have a shout out, just indicate the name you want to use and include any messages that you'd like to be like to have read out on air. And so, again, thank you. We really very much appreciate this.
Yes, that comes from all of us.
Yeah, I wanted to add that being with Greg from the beginning and being co-founder, I was able to recognize several individuals just by virtue of the fact that you've been with Countercurrents for a very long time from the beginning. And so it means a lot to me to hear that you're still supporters and still with us. Thank you very much.
Well, great. The format of these shows is basically going to be this, right? We're going to have an intro where we talk a little bit, just say hi, whatever. Then we're going to do the donations. After that, we're going to have an interview, maybe for 30 minutes or so, with an author or some sort of movement personality, just whoever we think might be of interest to you. And then we're going to end each episode with a little segment I want to call Shop Talk, where we just talk about upcoming projects from Countercurrents, what's going on, just to update the community of our followers about what to expect in the coming months and weeks. So today's interview, though, is going to be with me. And the reason for that is that we decided to do this sort of at the last minute. This was one of our recent brainstorms. And also, I just returned from nearly 6 weeks in Europe on what I like to call a European listening tour. I did speak for six times. I did give six talks while I was in Europe. But I spent a lot of time networking, learning as much as I can from European comrades, and I'm trying to bring that back to the United States, to the movement here, and apply it as much as I can, because I do think that although none of the European countries have the First Amendment, oddly enough, they're actually using their freedoms that they do have more effectively than we do in the United States. They put on really well-organized events. They have large parties, some of which have significant representation in the various parliaments of their countries. There's a lot we can learn from our European friends.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, since I've spent a lot of time in Europe over the last few years, I mean, I find it ironic and a little bit tragic, I have to say, that now, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people on the European right, I mean, they're talking about the alt-right to the U.S. And my response when I hear that is just like, why? You know, I mean, I think they have a much more thriving and dynamic thing going on here, both in the East and the West, although they're different, than anything going on in America.
Yeah, it's sort of the grass is always greener, right? I think that we think that things must be really happening in Europe, and the Europeans think things must be really happening in the United States. And unfortunately, though, only one of those opinions is true. And at least my attitude, which is that there's a lot going on in Europe that we need to copy, is, I think, correct. I think that the Europeans have less to gain from the American movement than the Americans have to gain from the European movement. Therefore, I do not want to be the ugly American coming to Europe to tell them how to do it. I'm here. I will share my ideas because people are patient enough and gracious enough to listen to me speak to them in a foreign language, which is not a courtesy that I can extend back. Yet, primarily I'm here to listen, or I was there to listen. And so I just want to talk a bit about the different, you know, places I went, the events that I attended. And if you guys have questions and stuff, just, you know, burst in. And so this doesn't devolve into some kind of monologue on my part.
Right. Well, your first stop on the trip was in Sweden for the Skanza, if I'm correct. Or did you stop somewhere else first? Okay.
No, I flew to Sweden and I went to Skanza Forum. That was on the 20th of May. It was the first meeting ever of the Skanza Forum, and it was a good meeting. The inaugural meeting featured Kevin MacDonald, who flew halfway around the world to speak there, and also me. I also flew from the United States to speak there. Guillaume Durocher came from the continent to speak, and we also had a panel with Jonas de Geer and the Golden One on it. And so that went really quite well. The panel went really well. All the talks went well, but the panel went well too. And I think people really enjoyed it because it was a Q&A thing from the audience. Every speaker got to say a few words, and it was just exciting, right? We answered their questions. We weren't telling them what we think. We were answering their questions, following their agenda. And it was so popular that they decided to do it at the next Skanza Forum meeting, and I also decided that we need to do this at the New York Forum in the future, and also in the Northwest Forum, which are things that I'm organizing. So the talk I gave was on Heidegger and the Jewish question, and that talk is online as a YouTube video, and a text with the same title that covers the same topic but isn't exactly the same as the lecture is also up now at Countercurrents. So I thought that went really, really well. But this time I only spent 2 days in Stockholm, basically, just attending the event and hanging out a bit with friends and doing some networking. And then I went on to my next destination.
Which was
Estonia. And Ruben Kaalep from Blue Awakening, which is the nationalist youth movement, is a friend of mine. I met him a couple of years ago at the London Forum. And again, when he came to the United States to speak at AMREN. And, you know, he's a young guy. He's highly intelligent. He's translated some of my articles into Estonian, which is how I first got to know him. You know, and I was quite honored by that. And he's a leader. So he leads the youth movement of the Nationalist Party in Estonia. So what I did is, actually, Kevin MacDonald decided to come to Estonia too. So we booked a passage on the Tallink Baltic Queen, which is a cruise ship / ferry boat where you can, you know, take your car on too. And it left Stockholm Sunday afternoon, and it traveled all night, and in the morning landed in Tallinn, Estonia. And the cruise ship experience was really wonderful, actually. It was, well, it was full of white people from the Baltic. There was one non-white who was a really bad singer, singing jazz standards in English, mangling the pronunciations horribly in one of the, the lounges on the ship. But that was it. Everybody else was white. Basically, it seemed to consist of a lot of Swedish boomers, and the other group that was quite large were young Russian families, including hundreds and hundreds of kids. And they were having some kind of big awards ceremony, and there were all these Russian girls wearing dresses and wreaths on their heads, and there were various costumes, and everyone was dressed up. Everyone looked really elegant. You know, they were passing out certificates and posing for pictures, and this just went on and on and on. It was quite enjoyable to be just surrounded by all these families with kids, and it was my first taste of you know, the Baltic states, I guess. I don't know if these were actually Russians who live in the Baltic states or if they were headed back to Russia. I'm just not sure, but it was overwhelmingly white, and the initial reaction that I felt was I just felt so relaxed. It was funny. It was a relaxing and pleasant and engaging atmosphere, and it's also just beautiful cruising through all these islands off the coast of Sweden. And of course, it got dark kind of late, and so you know, could sit out and watch the islands. We had dinner, and then in the morning, I got up, had breakfast, and we pulled into Tallinn. And Tallinn is a beautiful place. It's this medieval city. It's a Hanseatic city, you know, with old buildings and a citadel and city walls perched on a hilltop. And Kevin and I met up with Ruben and some of his comrades in Blue Awakening, and we went and did some museuming. And the first thing that we did was... I was skeptical. I thought, why are we going off to a seaplane hangar? Look, there's this beautiful medieval city over here. Why are we going to this place called the Seaplane Hangar Museum or something to that effect? Well, it turns out that it was a really good choice. It's a building that was built in 1914 by the Tsars, the Tsarist Empire, and it was for their seaplanes in the Tsar's Navy or Air Force. I don't know what a seaplane would be categorized as naval or aviation. But anyway, it's this huge structure with these three interlocking domes built out of concrete. It was built by a Danish firm, and it's immense. It's a really impressive piece of engineering. Something I'd never heard of. And it's been turned into a museum, basically, of everything connected with Estonia and the ocean, or the Baltic. And so they had like the earliest fragmentary ships that have been found in excavations in Estonia, up to various airplanes and things that were connected with seaplanes, and also an entire submarine that they purchased. The interwar Estonian Republic purchased this from the British. The British built it, and it was taken over by the Red Army after Estonia was taken over by the Red Army, taken over again when the Red Army came back, and it was basically in operation for 75 years, and then it was decommissioned and hauled out and put in a museum. And so we could get on board the submarine and look at the quarters and everything. Quite impressive. And then after that, we went into the old city of Tallinn. And that evening, I met up with some Blue Awakening people, and I gave a presentation. They chose the topic, and they wanted to talk about language, myth, and identity, things like that, over dinner, and it was a really good time. And the next day we went to tramped all around the old city, the Hanseatic city, ate lunch in a medieval restaurant that basically had a menu like they'd have in the Middle Ages. So there were no potatoes on the menu, for instance, because they didn't have those then. But the food was excellent. The next day we took a train to Tartu, which is sort of the cultural capital of Estonia. And we went to the National Museum there, which is a kind of depressing modern structure. But one thing that really struck me about it was the underlying premise of the museum is a complete rejection of multiculturalism. Because of more than 40 years of Russian occupation after the end of the Second World War, there are significant numbers of Russians were settled in Estonia, and many Estonians were killed or deported to other places in the Soviet Union. And there are still lots of Russians there today. There are 20 to 30%, maybe more, of the population. And they're a very distinct ethnic group. They look different. They're a different subracial type from the Estonians. And if you go to the museum, the National Museum of Estonia completely rejects the idea that Estonia is multicultural. It's simply about the Estonian people and its history. And the only other peoples that it really deals with are the other Finno-Ugric language-speaking peoples of the Baltic, like Finland, but also peoples in the Urals, because there are a lot of Finno-Ugrian tribes, if you will, that still exist in Russia. And I thought it was just kind of fascinating. It was a very interesting museum of a folk culture that's very, very ancient, and that goes back on that land to the Stone Age, to the Neolithic Age, basically. So I enjoyed that. I gave another talk in Tartu that evening, and we talked about a theme that I think is pretty important, which is there's a tendency a lot of our people have to want to drop out and think that we need to drop out of society. And my argument was, no, if I were the system, if I were in charge of this system, I'd be delighted if all of the dissidents would drop out and go and live on hippie communes in the woods or something like that. I'd be delighted with that because, they're less of a threat that way. And that got a good discussion going. Then I went back the next day, spent another day in Tallinn, went to the National Art Museum, which again, completely rejected multiculturalism. It was all about art in Estonia. Now, some of the artists in Estonia were ethnically German or ethnically Swedish, but it rejected the idea that today what Estonia is a multicultural society. So I thought that was quite good. And then some interesting stuff on Soviet-era art, including some pretty interesting socialist realist stuff, which I kind of like. Socialist realist art, actually. I'd like to see a really good exhibition on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It wasn't that different from what the futurists were doing or you know, any number of other art movements in Western Europe at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. It was very interesting to see that in Estonia, throughout its history, every Western European or Central European art movement had its Estonian followers, people who in Estonia who wanted to paint or sculpt in those styles. And so it was interesting to look at Estonian romantics and Estonian modernists, Estonian impressionists, Estonian symbolists, and so forth. It was quite interesting. And a lot of these artists were really quite talented, and I'd never heard of any of them, to be quite honest. So it was a really positive experience. So all told, it was a great time. Estonians are really attractive people on average. I was told that Estonia has more top models per capita than any other country in the world, and I can believe that. You know, they tend to be tall and long-headed, fair-haired, Nordic-type people. You know, they look like Swedes and Norwegians, pretty much. And yet they have this Finno-Ugric language, which is quite interesting to listen to and quite foreign to anything in our experience. Although you've spent a lot of time in a Finno-Ugrian language culture in Hungary, John.
Yes. Yes, I hear it's still somewhat debated, you know, exactly where all these countries fit together, but it seems to be, you know, more or less accepted that that's the case. Although I've been told that, like, I actually met a Finnish guy at a pub here in Budapest months ago, and he was telling me that, like, you know, they can't understand each other, though, today. It's not that, you know, you can speak modern Finnish to somebody and a modern Hungarian will understand it. But
that's what I was told.
I guess the evidence suggests is that they do come from the same root.
Yeah. They have very distant common ancestors, but there's no real mutual intelligibility between the languages today. That's what I was told. And they had Hungary on the map of all the Finno-Ugrian speakers at that National Museum, too. But it's sort of an outlier because it's so far removed from the other populations, and also because of separate linguistic development in isolation, the languages really aren't mutually intelligible. It's like us listening to somebody speaking Russian or Polish.
Speaking of Russians, how were during your time in Estonia, were you able to spot the differences? Were you able to tell apart the Russians from the Estonians just based on looks, or?
Almost always. The Russians are very typically Slavic. They tend to be fair-haired, blue-eyed people. They tend to have stockier builds, and their heads are a little rounder, basically, than the Estonians, who have sort of long heads. And, you know, I could look around in the hotel breakfast room when I would come in. I could sort of, like, say, I bet these people are Russians over here. And I'd take my little tray and sit down, and sure enough, they'd be speaking Russian. And also, Polish NATO soldiers are stationed in Estonia. And I could tell I could tell that they were Slavs before I even saw the Polish flag on their uniforms. You know, these were big guys, but they had a distinctly Slavic as opposed to Estonian look about them. And I could see they were all wearing uniforms, and it's like, well, I bet these aren't Estonian soldiers. And sure enough, when they got closer, I could see they had the Polish flag on their uniform sleeves. So I guess they're as part of NATO.
Could you differentiate them from the Russians if it weren't for the flags?
Or? I couldn't. I would have just thought maybe they were Russians, but I didn't think they were Russians because I thought Russians in uniforms in Estonia, I think people would be like running if they walked into the breakfast room. So yeah, I thought, yeah, they had to be from somewhere else, and yeah, they were Polish. But yeah, there are distinct sub-racial types in Europe, and these communities, they live in the same country in Estonia, but they tend to be kind of aloof from one another. And one of the Blue Awakening people, though, is ethnically Russian, but he wasn't an Estonian Russian. He was a Russian who somehow ended up in Estonia. and is interested in all of their work. So, I mean, the Estonian nationalists, like so many ethno-nationalists in Europe, both have a strong identification with their unique culture and language and homeland and their nation, their ethno-states, and they have a fairly broad sense that, you know, beyond these differences, we all have common European roots. So it's, and I could see that, and I saw that dual consciousness in many, many circumstances when I was in Europe on this trip. And yeah, of course, politically today, Estonia and Russia are not friendly, because the Estonians feel like, and quite rightly, that the Russians are the biggest threat to their independence still. Still, there is this enlarged sense of common Europeanness. Mike, you and I had a really interesting experience of that in Budapest when we went to the opera and saw René Papa, the German baritone, give a recital. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
That's right. That was a great night. I've only been to the Opera House here on a few occasions. I've only lived here a little over a year, so that was actually only the second time I'd been there. And every time I go, the architecture stands out of the place. And I think you might have told me that the acoustics in there are, it's like the best opera house now that one in, I think, Venice is no longer around.
It's La Scala in Milan.
Yeah, that was always number one, but it's not anymore.
They did some renovations to their stage, and they sort of messed up the acoustics. But I honestly have to say that the acoustics in the opera house in Budapest are amazing. I went and saw a dress rehearsal of Ariadne of Naxos there. And although the production was absolute Euro trash, just one of the worst productions I've ever seen of any opera, there was a simple cure to that, which is to close your eyes or to look up at the beautiful ceiling and the chandelier and things like that, and just listen to the sound, because I've never heard it sound more beautiful than in that space. It really is an amazingly warm and friendly acoustic. But anyway, we saw Papa, and he did, or Papa, he did this recital. It was, first half was Verdi, and the second half was Wagner. And the audience in Hungary, Hungarians are really committed to European high culture.
I've actually read that there's more people attend plays and opera performances in Budapest per capita than any other city in Europe, which is pretty amazing when you think about all the culture that there is throughout Europe.
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, in New York City, the Metropolitan Opera generally does about 24 productions a season. And the first time when I visited you in Budapest in 2015, I got the catalog for the Hungarian State Opera, and that season they were doing 72 productions. This is in a country of fewer than 10 million people, and that indicates a level of commitment that you just don't have in the United States to European high culture. And, you know, the audience was really, really enthusiastic, and one of the things I love about Hungarian audiences is there will be just sort of spontaneous applause, and then the applause sort of falls into this rhythmic clapping. Everyone claps in unison. And what happens then is sometimes it takes on a kind of ominous quality. If the performer is off stage and you want him to come back and take another bow, the clap, the iron rhythmic clapping becomes sort of ominous. Well, anyway, The singer came out several times and did bows, and then he came out and did an encore. And the encore was from a children's opera by Ronke, I hope that's the correct pronunciation, called King Pomada's New Clothes. I guess it's basically the Emperor's New Clothes. And I think every Hungarian knows this opera. at least the ones in that opera house, because they were just delighted when they heard the music. And this German singer came out and sang to them in Hungarian. And I was looking at the Hungarian ladies near me, and they were sort of looking at one another, smiling, because he was kind of butchering the pronunciation in places, I think. And yet when it was done, the level of enthusiasm in that room was just off the charts. I thought they were enthusiastic about the Wagner, but this was like a whole new level of enthusiasm. And it was actually moving. And what we were experiencing was national pride.
That's what I was going to remark on. Yeah, that stood out to me at the end. It was Wagner was obviously the more famous composer there, and everything we'd heard earlier was very well known, but I had never heard of this, you know, composer of the Hungarian opera. And yet, you know, when he came out and that piece was performed, the enthusiasm from the crowd, as you said, Greg, was just amazing. Everybody was, everybody knew the lyrics, mm-hmm. you know, to this opera I had never even heard of.
Yeah, yeah. We just don't have an experience of that kind of national enthusiasm in America. And this is an educated, upper-middle-class audience, probably sort of center-lefty.
Maybe not so much at the opera house, but I'm not so
yeah,
sure.
Well, I mean, certainly in the United States, people who see these things tend to be...
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant in Hungary, yeah.
Yeah, but I was maybe even in Hungary, too. I don't know. But the fact was is that there was such national enthusiasm in that room, and it was such a pure, refined experience of it, because we could see what superb performances of European high culture elicited from that audience, and it was great enthusiasm, but this was something on a higher level. It was a whole new experience, and it was kind of a beautiful, kind of controlled experiment, if you will, and it's an experience that everybody should have.
Oh, and in Hungary, you see it all the time. I mean, I can't even count the number of times I've experienced things like that. You know, I mean, like on their national days when, you know, thousands, of, I mean, when Orban speaks on, you know, on March 15th or on August 20th, well, actually he does come out on August 20th. I mean, you can't even get near the squares where the speaking is going, as they're just jam packed with people. You know, there's all these rituals that they go through that date back, you know, in some cases hundreds of years. And yeah, it's something I never really remember experiencing growing up as an American. I mean, there was always, you know, like on the 4th of July or whatever, like there was kind of this vague pride, but it never really went to that level, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And educated people in the United States especially tend to be ironical about whatever level of patriotism they actually experience.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not genuine, heartfelt enthusiasm. They would feel odd to feel that.
That 9/11 was like the test case for that, because there was a period of about a year after 9/11, if you remember, where it wasn't cool all of a sudden to criticize America or to criticize Bush, so on and so forth.
Right.
So you saw all these, you know, hipsters and comedians and everything try to be patriotic, and you can tell that they just felt absolutely ridiculous doing it. And then, you know, as soon as that passed, I think they were probably relieved that, you know, they could go back to the sarcasm.
Their sneering ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was actually a song in Team America, World Police, that sounded remarkably similar to an actual song that came out shortly after 9/11. And of course, you know, one was supposedly sincere and the other was parody. But, you know, you really couldn't tell the difference between the two.
Which one was that?
I don't know the name of it, but was it
the Freedom Isn't Free thing?
Yes, yeah, exactly. it was like that. I think the Freedom Wasn't Free was in the movie, so that was just a parody, but the actual song that it was parodying was so close to that that it was almost indistinguishable. So
I kind of got ahead of myself, but that's fine. I mean, we're just having a conversation. Before I got to Hungary, though, I did spend a few days in London. And I went and spoke at the first Jonathan Bowden dinner. They're going to be doing an annual Jonathan Bowden dinner in England now. And I think it's a wonderful thing. Stead Steadman is the guy who organized
it. Oh, great guy.
I spoke. Adam Wallace spoke, Max Musson spoke. They're going to be using it as a place to give the annual Jonathan Bowden Award for Oratory, which I think is a wonderful thing to do. And they gave that to Jez Turner this year, and he certainly deserved it. He's a really very effective and rousing speaker. So I was honored. I gave a very brief talk, and that talk is basically the foreword to a book that is going to come out very soon from Countercurrents called Extremists, Studies in Metapolitics, which is basically 9 transcripts of Jonathan's orations on various figures. Most of them are about individuals. The first piece is called Vanguardism, Hope for the Future, and then the others are about specific figures who were metapolitical extremist types and people he admired and recommends to us to admire and imitate as well.
I was just working on it earlier.
And that's great. Yeah, I'm sure everyone's going to be really excited when that comes out. And the next day I spoke at the London Forum, and that was a very, very enjoyable experience. There were, looked like more than 100 people there, if not more, certainly very close. It was very well organized. They have a really good security team there that keeps track of everything, you know, very professional looking guys, but not the kind of people you want to mess with. And there were you know, Millennial Woes spoke, this fellow George Whale, who's an art teacher, spoke, really interesting lecture on memes. And I spoke, and I'm blanking out who else spoke. I apologize for that. But anyway, I give another Heidegger talk, which I just published the second segment of. It's called Heidegger and Ethnic Nationalism. And that's basically the talk that I gave, at this event. I didn't read it word for word, and I ad-libbed a bit, but I finally typed up the text, that I had prepared. And I believe it's online too on YouTube, the audio of the actual performance, if you will. And I met a lot of people, new people, hung out with some old friends, spent a few days in London, met up with some people like, well, I'll just say hi to some of them, Madeline and Bane. And Mick and Jez, of course, and there were many others. It was a really very good time. Tom Sunich spoke, and I got to spend some time with Tom too. So that was all really enjoyable. I went to the British Museum. I went to the National Gallery. Pilgrimage sites, you know, for anyone who wants to go to London. And I was actually thinking, you know, I could just really get into living in London, you know, rent a little room in central London and just spend 6 months sponging up all the culture. And then practically the day I get to Hungary, the latest terrorist attack took place, and that fantasy just disappeared. London is just it's a changed place. There are large segments of it that just do not feel like a European city anymore, much less one of the great European cities of the past. It's so sad.
That's a terrible shame.
I could live there for 6 months, I think, but beyond that, I don't know. I mean, London really, you know, I'm from New York, and London is more like New York City than any other city in the world that I've been to, I have to say. And that's not very complimentary for London.
My praise.
Because it doesn't seem very British anymore. I mean, of course, if you're around, you know, Parliament, Big Ben, you know, places like that, like, okay, yeah, sure, it's English. But I mean, when you're just in the city, you know, it doesn't feel very, very English anymore. Whereas if you go out to the countryside or to the small towns, I still feel like you get some sense of what traditional England was like, but not so much in London.
Yeah, I would agree, but still, even in its fallen state, London is one of the most magnificent cities I've ever been in. And a friend of mine said, if you get tired of looking at the people on the sidewalks, if they depress you, just look up at the buildings.
Yes.
They're just so magnificent.
Make sure not to get hit by a crazed Muslim behind the wheel of some
a truck of peace.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you can't be looking up at the buildings all the time. You might get run down or knifed by some jihadi. That is true. another friend I was out with pointed out all the modern buildings that we looked at looked older, sadder, and drabber than anything built in the 19th century or earlier. That was really true. Yeah, and it does have some of the great museum collections in the world. The security at the British Museum at the National Gallery is pretty tight. So I actually felt pretty safe wandering around places like that. It really does give you pause, though. When just before I went there was the Manchester bombing and another terrorist attack in London, the Westminster attack. And then after that was the London Bridge attack. And there will be more. You know, when we tag articles on various terrorist events, it's like you can't just have something generic like
even the
London
year isn't
massacre.
Enough anymore. It's like you have to have
because
the month, or maybe we'll get to the we'll have to have the month.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I'm laughing, but of course, it's not really funny. It's tragic, but I just feel like it's funny that we're still considered those of us who speak up about these things and about the fact that this is being caused by the fact that we're letting in all these ethnic aliens to our countries, yet we're still considered somehow beyond the pale by the mainstream. It's just amazing to me. Yes.
For noticing. The war on noticing. It's really true. I was in Budapest for a month, and that was a great time. It was a time to get work done. Unfortunately, the day after I got there, my plans to work on the White Nationalist Manifesto were sort of knocked off track by Freeburg's attack and the first of his attacks. And so, I spent a lot of time just dealing with this completely unnecessary movement drama while I was there. And it sort of set back the production schedule for my manifesto project. But still, I did get a lot of work done. I did get a lot of book editing done while I was there. Because if I'm not able to focus on writing, which requires a lot of focus and calm for me, I am still very able to edit other people's work and send emails and just organize things. And so we really moved ahead significantly with a number of projects while I was in Budapest. So I feel happy about that. I think it was a productive time. In the end, it just wasn't the production that I had planned for. But when these things happen, you just have to do that. It's like, yeah, okay, somebody knocks you off your stride or whatever with one project. Well, there's never any shortage of other things that you can turn your attention to that might be easier to work on in a more stressful situation.
That's right. You just have to keep on moving forward. And one of the reasons I came on board really was to allow both you, Greg, and John to focus on book production, book editing, and these are all tasks that you've done successfully and very well, I might add, for a long period of time. And I really look forward to seeing the White Nationalist Manifesto come out. And Yeah, I look forward, you know, I'm happy to be the webzine editor and be able to, you know, get involved on a level that I haven't been, for, you know, some little bit of time. So,
yeah, well, in the past you were sort of behind the scenes, keeping the machine running. And I think it's more engaging for you, and personally rewarding to be working more directly with authors. And I'm hoping that eventually you'll be representing Countercurrents at various events that are going on around Europe as well, and maybe things in the United States too, because you're going to be coming back from time to time, because you still have family here, of course. So, yeah, I think that this is a step towards you being more publicly engaged in the movement, which I think is good, because we need more people who are out there under their own name.
Absolutely.
You should start writing again, Mike.
Yes. Well, I've been commenting. I've been replying to comments and articles at Countercurrents just within this past week, and that's definitely a step towards producing a full-length article.
I agree. I often would get the inspiration for writing out something by dealing with discussions online. I think for a lot of people, they can be a terrible waste of time, and they can be a waste of time for me too, unless I've got an eye towards leveraging them into something more permanent, less ephemeral than just online comments. And so I recommend everyone to do that. James O'Meara, who's one of my favorite people in this thing, will come up with the most brilliant and funny comments just on Facebook. And I keep saying, James, you know, not that many people see these things. This is great stuff. Your Facebook wall's on fire today. You need to write up an article about this stuff. I've been encouraging him to do that more. And I want him to get on Twitter, too, because I think he'd build a huge following with his little bon mots.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the way to communicate among the millennial generation and younger generations, which is why I added John and my Twitter links on the sidebar at Countercurrents.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Yeah, I think we can add that information for all of our authors.
Yeah, we should start doing that. And put my Twitter, a link to the...
The New Right America, of course, yeah.
I would like that as well.
I saw earlier this year that you did an interview with Tara McCarthy of Reality Calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I know she's based in England. I was wondering if you met her while you were over there.
No, I didn't. I would like to meet her. I thought she was...
She's in the U.S. a lot, too.
Right.
Because she has an American boyfriend, fiancé.
Yeah, that's right. I thought she was going to be speaking at AMRIN this year, and I see that she's not going to be there now, which is unfortunate. I was actually looking forward to meeting her. Let me just mention this. I am going to be at AMRIN this year. I guess we can include this under the Shop Talk thing. Later, but I will be at AMRIN later this year, and we can talk more about that. One thing, I spent a month in Hungary, met up with some really interesting people, got a lot of work done. Then I went and spent a few days in Norway. That was my first visit to Norway. I really liked Oslo. A lot of Norwegians think, oh, it's such a decadent city, etc. It's still far nicer, far healthier than any city in the United States for all of its problems. And,
sure.
You know, it's
just like Stockholm.
Exactly. It's got some beautiful buildings, some really nice museums. I went to see the Viking Ship Museum, which I really liked. It has three old Viking ships, two of which are in fantastic states of preservation. I went to the Kon-Tiki Museum and saw the Kon-Tiki and Ra 2 boats created by Thor Heyerdahl, who, ever since I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, was a hero of mine. I've read most of his books, some of them multiple times, and it was really exciting to actually see those ships. There's a museum there in the same area for the Fram, the Arctic expeditionary vessel, so I saw that as well. Arctic exploration is one of those great Faustian things. That, and of course, these Norwegians were very much a part of that, given their history of being explorers and the fact that they live in a cold northerly climate. It just made sense for them to keep pushing towards both poles. And they they did so heroically, and it's really one of the great feats of, you know, intelligence. It requires so much intelligence and planning to do this properly. Intelligence, planning, foresight, but also a huge amount of bravery, because and just strength and endurance to do this kind of stuff. And now, you know, of course, we can just fly to the South Pole or the North Pole in an airplane, but at the time, it was, you know, the last great frontier before space. And then I spoke at the Skanza Forum, the second Skanza Forum event, which was held in Oslo. There were about 90 people there. It was the first event of its kind in Norway, and it was well attended. There were some people who came from Sweden as well to participate and give support. And there were mostly the people there were Norwegian, of course, and I would say about 50% of them had never attended any kind of IRL real-world event before this one. So it was a big step. It was an act of courage, a little social risk for these people to come out. It was well rewarded. The event went off without a hitch. There was no sabotage. There were no Antifa, nothing like that. The day before, or a couple of days before, there was a front page article in the Dagbladet, which is the big daily paper, about the Skanza Forum happening. But it was not interrupted or infiltrated, so that was really good.
Can I ask you, Greg? I'm a little uncertain. What exactly is the sort of the purpose or the purview of the Skanza Forum? Like, do you know exactly what the organizers are intending to do with it? Like, who's I assume it's mainly for a Scandinavian audience, but do you know what exactly their goal is with the...
It's inspired by the London Forum, just like the New York Forum is, just like the Northwest Forum, the Atlanta Forum, which I don't have anything to do with. The Atlanta Forum is just something that people in Atlanta are organizing, but it's the same model. It's a meta-political gathering. It's a place where dissidents can come and enjoy fellowship and exchange ideas and come up with opportunities and plans and things like that. It's a place to scheme, and it works really well. People need something where there's real social interaction, and everyone was really nice. Everyone was really polite. The food was excellent. The talks were really good. Lauritz von Gildhausen gave a talk. Olaf. Oh gosh, I'm so embarrassed. I'm blanking on his last name. He's one of the organizers of the Skanza Forum. Gave a talk in Norwegian, as well he should. All the other talks were in English. I gave a talk. Millennial Woes gave a talk, and Mike Enoch of the Daily Showa gave a talk, and they were all really well received. And the Q&A session, the panel at the end, was really very stimulating.
One of the point I will remark on the fact that even though it's the Skanza Forum, but still currently it seems like they are inviting a lot of non-Scandinavians to come speak there.
Well, I mean, the London Forum has lots of people who aren't English, and the New York Forum, you know, we had a British speaker at our first event, Adrian Davis. So it's national and it's international at the same time. All the people there are very much attached to their own homelands. And yet they also have a broadened sense that white nationalism is a universal thing. And indeed, ethno-nationalism for all nations is a good thing. And they're willing to learn from one another. They want to network with people throughout the global white nationalist movement, and I just think it's really a healthy thing. So again, I learned a lot from the Norwegians. I want to spend more time in Norway.
Yes. Well, your statement that 50% of the people in attendance were coming out for the first time in real life was quite a statistic. I recall the euphoria I felt at my first in real life event, so I can definitely relate to that. I know the situation in Sweden is much worse, but most of the Scandinavians I know who are active in pro-white causes, of course, you know, are located in Sweden.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sweden is maybe twice as populous as Norway. So, you know, it's just a bigger country. And Sweden has always been in the top 10 of countries in terms of countercurrents readership, and has been ever since this website got started. And I always thought that was interesting. Norway pops in and out of the top 20 all the time. Finland is usually in the top 20, often in the top 10. Denmark is never really prominent in our traffic for whatever reason. I think because it's such a happy country. And they do have some immigration problems and things like that, but they quietly sort of tighten the valves on that. And it's just not as much of a threat there as it is in the other Scandinavian countries, for whatever reason.
I felt that too.
Yeah, so I think that there's a good reason why Swedes read us a lot. The situation there is bad, and Swedes have a great, very high level of English competence. Basically, every Swede that I met was capable of conversing with me more or less in English, and even more can read English, even if they're not comfortable speaking it, which is pretty amazing. And like I'm always saying when I go to Europe, you guys are coming out to listen to me speak to you in a foreign language, and it is something that I could not do, the reverse. I simply couldn't reciprocate. There are some foreign languages that I can understand. I remember I heard a lecture in Berkeley years ago from Carlo Petrini, the guy who created the slow food movement, and he spoke in Italian. And even though I hadn't really studied any Italian in a systematic way, I had studied Spanish for 2.5 years, and I sort of look at Italian texts like opera libretti and things like that. So, I mean, I have some Italian vocabulary. And I actually found that I could I could follow maybe 50% of what he was saying without any difficulty. Like, oh, I know what he's saying. Oh, I know what he's saying. Oh, I can laugh at this point because I know it was a joke, right? That kind of thing. And with French and German, sometimes, you know, it's 80% I'll be able to listen to and understand if people are speaking. But Norwegian, there's no way. There's just no way. But the Norwegians and Swedes come out to listen to me, and I'm always flattered by that.
Right. I had had somewhat of an unusual experience as an American, as an English speaker, or somebody who hasn't had to deal with foreign languages most of my life, at a local meeting of the Identitarians, the Generation Identity, here in Budapest in May. The invited speakers were Carl Richter, who is a city councilman in Munich, and Daniel Freiberg of Arctos. And Carl Richter, when he spoke, he doesn't speak Hungarian, obviously, so he spoke in German, and it was translated or interpreted into Hungarian via simultaneous interpretation. And I've studied German in school. I took it for 3 years, and I spent a summer abroad in Vienna, so I can understand it. I can't speak it as well as I can get the gist of it, but that was really a refreshing experience for me, actually, because, of course, you know, when Austria-Hungary existed, you know, German and Hungarian were the languages, you know. There's nobody here who really spoke English. I mean, there is a small percentage of people, obviously, but you know, that these two languages were the ones that were there at the meeting was a nice, you know, interesting experience to have been through.
You know, when we were in Munich in 2001, I thought your German was really quite good. I felt like an idiot. I felt like a child, and you were handling everything basically very well, just speaking to like the maids in hotels and things like that, and people at the Oktoberfest. I remember all that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to get comfortable with it, really, is to you know, actually be in situations where you practice it. And by that point, I had already done that. I, you know, had my summer abroad in Vienna. Mm-hmm. And
you're lucky.
Yeah. Well, things are much easier today. I mean, there's, you know, free language learning online, and it's, you know, the world is a smaller place. It's just a matter of you know, actually putting aside the time to really, you have to be in a situation where you can't fall back upon the language that's easiest for you, the crutch, you know, of English, which is very extremely difficult for all of us who have grown up with English as our native languages.
Yeah, and of course, when you're in Europe, Europeans, unless they're the French, they're delighted if you fall back into English because they're trying to learn it themselves oftentimes. So they're willing to let you loll around in your comfort zone and not learn so that they can pick your brain. But I really would like to spend significant periods of time in Germany. When I first visited Berlin,
and Austria.
Yeah. When I first visited Berlin, I thought, my gosh, I was totally surprised at how likable Berlin was and how German it felt compared to, say, France, which doesn't feel French anymore. Or Paris, I should say, doesn't feel like a French capital. But Berlin certainly felt like a German capital and a European capital. And
I think that's maybe because of for all of its flaws, the one good thing we can say that the Soviet Union did for, you know, the eastern half of Europe is it preserved it from westernization for 50 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it was also very reasonably priced, and I thought, gosh, you know, if I spent 6 months in Berlin, I could live there fairly cheaply and finally get fluent in German. I just need to be immersed in it I need to be in a sink or swim situation before I start swimming in another language, unfortunately. I just don't have the initiative to get fluent any other way, I'm afraid.
Right. Well, I just want to chime in. We've been doing the interview for about an hour now.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, yeah. It's a time flies. It's been good.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little shop talk.
Before we get, can I just say something briefly, Greg?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I didn't have as big of a tour as you did, but I was recently just back in the U.S. for a while. And I had the pleasure to address the New York Forum in May on Julius Evola. And the text of my talk has since been published at Countercurrents. You can go find it. It was called What Would Evola Do? Mm-hmm. And it was the first New York Forum I'd been to, and I really liked it. I there are a few people there who I knew, but most I didn't. A few people I'd only known over social media, but had never met in person.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there were probably about 40 people there.
That sounds about right.
And it was a very pleasant event. I was really glad to, since I'm from New York, the irony is since I first became active, on the new right, alt-right, whatever you want to call it, I'd never actually been to any event in New York, so that it kind of felt like a homecoming for me, and I really enjoyed that, and everybody who came up and shook my hand and introduced themselves, I appreciated that, because, you know, when you're spending all your time on your computer, you tend to kind of lose sight of the fact that, hey, you know, this work really affects real life people. And when they come up to you and say that, oh, your writing or, the work that you did, the editing work at Arctos or whatever, that really made a difference to me. I mean, that's so gratifying to hear, that when, somebody actually takes the trouble to come up to you and thank you for something that you did. So it was a great event. I hope that you're able to keep those going in New York, because you kind of feel like you're, it's this little island in a sea of the most extreme depravity and decadence, but
Oh yeah, I'm definitely going to keep the New York Forum going. We could talk about books next time, because I guess we are kind of running out of time, and I don't want these things to run on much past an hour. So let's do some shop talk, and basically I just want to mention a couple of things. I am going to be, and more speaking things, basically. At the end of this month in July, I'm going to be at the American Renaissance Conference. I have not been at American Renaissance since 2008. It's a very long time. And I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to have a table laden with Countercurrents books, and I will be there signing my own books. I'll even sign other people's books if I edited them, right? If my name appears on it in some fashion or another, I will sign it too. But I'll be selling books, signing books, and meeting old friends and making new friends. And I'm very much looking forward to it. Also, I will be speaking at this event. I'm not one of the headline speakers. I'm just going to be speaking in a session that they set aside for briefer reports about movement activities. And so I'm going to just give a little talk about countercurrents and what we're up to and what people can look forward to in the future. So that's at the end of this month in July. At the end of August, Jared Taylor is going to be speaking at the Northwest Forum somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm going to give a talk there as well. And there will be one other speaker. I don't know if he wants his name out there yet, so I'm just going to leave it out right now. But we're going to have three speeches or three talks, whatever you want to call them, plus a Q&A panel type session like we've done at the Scanza Forum. So that's at the end of August, the 26th of August. And then in New York in September, on the 18th of September, which is a Monday, we're going to do a special New York Forum. It's going to be a dinner in honor of the 100th birthday of Francis Parker Yockey. And I will give a talk. There might be a couple other talks at this dinner. And there will also be photographs that have never been seen publicly. I have done a lot of digging to find never-before-published photos of Francis Parker Yockey, because, of course, for years, the only photos you saw were one passport photo and that famous picture of him in the handcuffs just before his death. And I have found dozens of photos that have never been published before, including photos connected with his suicide and the coroner's inquest and things like that. So, yeah, it's neat. So I'll be showing the photos. I'm going to maybe do like a slide presentation, like a PowerPoint thing, where I'll show all these Yockey photos and talk about the state of the art in Yockey studies. And of course, at the same time, we're going to release a volume of all of Yockey's shorter writings called The World in Flames, edited by Kerry Bolton. And Kerry, of course, has been doing a definitive biography of Yockey. So he's really the guy to speak about Yockey's 100th anniversary.
For sure.
And one of the things we'll do at that time is at least do an interview with him, and maybe have him write an article about it too, because he's definitely the most well-read guy on Yockey there is alive today.
And well, he's done a lot of, you know, first-hand research and primary documents too.
Lots of stuff.
I was going to say, it would be great if you could fly him in, but I know that would be expensive from New Zealand.
Yeah, he doesn't like to fly. Okay. We've been trying to get him to the United States for years. Charlie Kraft, who's a huge fan, said, I will buy his ticket if he just comes to the United States and speaks. And he says, no, I don't like to fly. And it's a long, long flight to the U.S. from New Zealand. So I can't really blame him. So, you know, eventually the mountain will have to go to Muhammad, and Charles and I have actually talked about taking a trip to Australia and New Zealand just so we can meet up with Kerry Bolton and all the other people that we know down
there. Well, I'd go with you.
So
I love his stuff.
Yeah, I don't know when it's going to happen, but we'll try and make it happen. Maybe not this fall, but maybe early next year sometime.
Has Kerry Bolton been to Europe or Australia? I mean, I imagine he's been to Australia on several occasions, but...
I don't know. I don't know if he's gone to Europe. He might well have when he was younger, but he's in his 60s now, and he said he's got arthritis, and he doesn't like to sit still for long periods of time, apparently, so he just doesn't do air travel very well. That's what he says, so... But yeah, I'm going to visit him definitely eventually, and Charles probably will come with us too. So yeah, we're going to do a proper Yockey fest definitely for his 100th birthday. That's one of the things that I think Countercurrents has done well from the start, which is to keep track of the birthdays of important people and try and keep them, their names alive and bring these new people who are coming in up to speed about heroes in our movement.
Absolutely. And I've seen that even just, you know, I've seen the living pass into the deceased with the passing of Jonathan Bowden, of course. you know, who is a great orator. You know, I would say the best in the English language on the right, certainly within the past century. And Greg, you and I have heard some of his greatest speeches. In 2009, there was a conference we attended at the end of the year. That's where we heard what is arguably, but many people do say, was his best ever talk.
Yeah, and it's just a terrible shame that was never recorded. Yeah. Yeah, so sad. I was helping organize that conference, and we actually had a no recording policy, and honestly, I didn't know what to expect. You know, and
neither did I. I thought he was going to be terrible, to be honest.
Well, when he said
before the talk, yeah, about half an hour before he was going to get up to talk, we were, you know, by a bar, just kind of, you know, having a few drinks before the evening session, and he, you know, he wasn't drinking, but he remarked that he had no idea what he was going to talk about.
I always wondered how much preparation he did.
Yeah, he said that to me at the dinner table, too, and I just thought, oh, God, this is going to be a fiasco. And then he got up there and blew us all away. So it's important for us to mark these birthdays and death days and passings and things like that. This is how we build a community. And the community isn't just between the living. It's between the living and the dead and the ones yet to come.
Yes, the democracy of the dead. As Chesterton called it, we have to represent them too.
Yes.
Exactly. They're gone, but they will never be forgotten as long as we have something to say about the matter. So, guys, this has been really enjoyable. I hope the listeners out there have really enjoyed this as well. Mark your calendars. We're going to be doing this every Friday. And until next time, thank you for joining us at Countercurrents Radio.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, everybody. It's been great.